Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have Boston University's 22nd Great Debate, sponsored by the College of Communications Department of Journalism. Modeled after the Cambridge and Oxford University Union Society's public discussions, the Great Debate brings together alumni, faculty, and students in a lively but collegial forum to discuss current issues in communication and public affairs. Based on the tradition of audience-centered parliamentary debate, it involves a series of speeches alternating for and against the topic, and includes audience participation as members may comment prior to the panel's rebuttals. The audience then decides the outcome of the debate by voting with their feet and moving to the side of the room representing their decision. Tonight's question is, should the United States stay the course for victory in Iraq? Introducing our speaker is tonight's moderator, Boston University Journalism Department Chairman Robert Zelnick.
Good evening and welcome to the 22nd Great Debate sponsored by the Department of Journalism and the College of Communications here at Boston University. The question tonight is, should the U.S. stay the course for victory in Iraq? We're not naive. We know that these have been dark days for the U.S. effort. There have been serious political setbacks and in a high cost in lives and injury among our troops in Baghdad and various provinces. Victory is not at this point in sight. The difficulties are not the inventions of cowardly reporters fearful of leaving the security of the Green Zone or their liberal editors back home. At the same time, the bottom line is not yet written. Plans are on the table both within the administration and among its critics for converting retreat into advance. We chose the word to tonight's resolution carefully. We did it to draw the sharpest possible lines between the two sides and perhaps to allow our debaters to vet suggestions of their own. Let me introduce the panelists to you. Arguing in the affirmative will be Adib Farhah, a senior policy advisor to the American Lebanese Coalition and vice president of Cardiovascular Hospitals of America. He's been a lecturer at the Lebanese American University in Beirut and advisor to two men who rose to the prime ministership, and he's also been seen or read in most of this nation's prestige media outlets. Supporting Mr. Farrar will be Lieutenant General Thomas McInerney, Air Force retired. He's the founder of the consulting firm Government Reform Through Technology and president of Business Executives for National Security. He's currently the military affairs analyst for Fox News. So he'll report and you can decide. Arguing in the negative will be Ambassador Peter W. Galbraith, a political consultant and former ambassador to Croatia, a country not unfamiliar with ethnic strife, and Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. Let me describe a little bit about tonight's format for your benefit. We will begin with each lead speaker, beginning with the affirmative, presenting his case, and culminating with the number two debater, who will present the case for affirmative and negative. Now, following that, we have a traditional division of the audience, and we'll take a brief informal count of the House, see which side seems to have more human beings, and we'll declare one side or the other the winner of the debate. Okay, the question for tonight, should the U.S. stay the course for victory in Iraq? And our first speaker is my good friend Adib Farhah.
I must admit, it takes a bit of courage to defend this position at Boston and at Boston University, but I'm glad to know the rules. No eggs, no tomatoes in my face. At the outset, I'd like to make it clear that, and I'm on record having said that at the University of Harvard in a lecture that just I was invited to. It was scheduled several months before then, but it happened to take place the day after the fall of Baghdad. I'm on record as being opposed to American intervention in that war and opposed and predicting the sad predicament and the quagmire that we've been in now. Having said that, it was a war that was wrong to get involved in. but it would be a far worse mistake to get out of prematurely. We just can't walk out after being an elephant that went into a China shop, broke everything, and just walk out and ruin the whole neighborhood. And we will ruin the whole neighborhood. And those guys that are disenchanted are probably going to follow us home. Staying the course until victory in Iraq. When this was proposed to all the panelists by Dr. Zelnick, we had a lot of debate whether that was a good subject for the debate. We couldn't agree what staying the course is. Staying the course means different things to different people, sometimes different things to the same people at different times. Does staying the course mean keep doing the same thing? Is it merely not to cut and run, to use, you know, another slogan? Is it not to set a deadline for withdrawal? Or is it to stay in Iraq until stability is achieved, but change the tactics as needed as we go along? To me, staying the course means not cutting and running, not leaving prematurely, not giving the enemy your deadline, not showing all your cards ahead of time. You don't tell your enemy, well, I'm going to fight you for another half an hour, and I hope to beat you, but if I don't, I'm going home. Okay, you know, I guess he'll do whatever has to be done to waste a half an hour, and then you go home. President Bush has defined victory as effectively, essentially, staying the course, staying in Iraq until we can leave behind a stable government. Let's look at the alternative to staying the course. What is the alternative? Leaving prematurely, leaving Iraq in a mess, leaving either a failed state or worse, failed mini-states, empowering Iran even more than it's empowered. I think most of us in this room probably agree that Iran is probably the foremost sponsor of state terrorism in the world. It has nuclear ambitions, and it makes no bones about it. If we were to leave prematurely, if after a year or 18 months or whatever, those who propose that we should have a deadline, you know, if we leave after this lapse of time and we leave things the way they are today, we would have effectively handed over Iraq to the Iranians. All the fears that many in the Arab world have expressed, including King Abdullah of Jordan, a staunch ally of the United States, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, you'd think we'd be more creative with names, you know, they've all said, expressed their fears about the Shiite crescent. And for those of you who are not sufficiently familiar with the history of the Middle East, Sunni-Shiite conflict dates back nearly 1,400 years. Right now, Iran is a Shiite theocracy. The pro-Iranian Shiites in Iraq are probably the most dominant, both numerically and militarily on the ground. Syria is a staunch lackey and an ally of Iraq. Hezbollah has risen to be a major power broker in Lebanon. It was a state within the state before the July War. It is much more powerful morally and politically on the ground in Lebanon now. So this Shiite crescent goes from Iraq, from Iran to Iraq to Syria to Lebanon and to Palestinian territories where Iran's lackey and agent and ally Hamas is gaining popularity. They won the last election parliamentarily. That is one alternative. What do we do if we do that, if we cut and run, if we leave prematurely, if we leave that mess behind? Number one, we lose international credibility. Who is going to take the United States word seriously? It is not only dishonorable, but it actually breaks faith with the Iraqis who have put their faith in the United States. One more time, this wouldn't be the first time. After Desert Shield, when Iraq had to pull out, was thrown out of Kuwait that it had occupied, the United States encouraged the Shiites to rise against Saddam. They did. Saddam slaughtered tens of thousands of them. We did nothing about it. This would be yet another time where the United States would be perceived as having failed people who stood by its side. I don't think anyone would want that. It also confirms the anti-American propaganda that terrorists like bin Laden and many others, or anti-Americans around the world, propose that America is just a paper tiger. It doesn't have the stamina, it doesn't have the patience, it doesn't have the commitment to finish a job. And examples abound. Let's all remember what happened in Afghanistan. This country spent billions of dollars and a lot of political support to help the Afghanis get rid of the Soviets. Just before the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan, the United States closed down its embassy, effectively cut and run, only to discover about 10 years later that it's become the foremost haven of terrorism, where the Taliban and Osama bin Laden did all of their training. That ended up in 9/11. Well, that started with 9/11 probably and hasn't ended. We've done the same thing in Lebanon. President Reagan sent troops to Lebanon, supposedly as peacekeepers in 1984. Hezbollah, or whoever, bombed the U.S. Marine barracks, killing 241 innocent Marine while they were in their beds, in their barracks. What did the United States do? Cut and run. Left the country in a far worse mess than it was before the peacekeepers went in. Do I have to remind you of what happened in Somalia when President Clinton decided to pull out after 18 soldiers were killed, or was it 41? You know, we just can't afford to continue down this road. Leaving Iraq prematurely until victory, as defined as a stable, as democratic as you can get. Democracy cannot be built overnight, but at least you can establish the roots for it. But a stable, united Iraq. If we cut and run, if we leave, if we abandon the Iraqis before then, we're going to have a continued civil war. If we partition, or if we set the stage for partitioning, you're going to enrage a civil war. You're going to start or actually exacerbate the already started ethnic cleansing. You're going to give even more power to radical terrorist-sponsored Iran with nuclear ambitions, as we know. Shiite crescent will be realized. Sunni fundamentalism will rise as a reaction to the rise of the Shiite political power in the Levant and in the Far East and the Near East. What does that do to our friendly, to American-friendly regimes? What does that represent as a threat to America's allies in the Middle East? Israel, the Arab Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, and Lebanon. All of these countries, most of which are vital to our economy, all of which are vital to us politically and economically, are going to be in a far worse condition than they are now. These nations, that region, is strategically very important to the United States, to the free world. Partly, in large part, because of the oil, admittedly, but because of its strategic location being at the cross-section of Asia, Europe, and Africa. We can't afford to just cut and run. However, it's been sort of an axiom of American foreign policy. When in doubt, divide. We did that in Korea. We did that in Vietnam. We did that in Palestine. We did that in India. We did that in Cyprus. And I can go on and on. And in all of those cases, we have left those peoples and those countries suffering economically, politically, or both. To divide Iraq, what would you have? You'll have the Sunnis in the center as a state, as a canton. That's a state that will have no oil revenues. The people will be unhappy. The Sunnis have traditionally ruled Iraq. They're used to having all the revenues of Iraq come to them, and they're not about to accept that laying down. The Shiites are divided into two major categories. There are Hakim and people like him who would welcome a Shiite canton. Hakim is an ally of Iran. In fact, his allegiance is more to the Shiites of Iran than to fellow Iraqis, and he proved that because during the Iraq-Iran war, he fought with the Iranians against his own people. You've got the seculars like Alawi who are opposed to partition, and you've got other Shiites. Alawi, of course, is a Shiite. You've got other Shiites like Muqtada Sadr and Hassani who would like to be independent of Iran. They're no friends of the United States, but they're going to oppose partitioning. So you've got Shiites fighting among each other, pro-partition or anti-partition. You've got the Sunni Shiite rift. And then up north, you have the Kurds. You start partitioning, and you open a can of worms with the Kurds. The Kurds, for decades, have had dreams of an independent, freestanding Kurdistan that will be almost the size of France to realize their dream of Kurdistan, for which the canton or the partitioned mini-state of northern Kurdish Iraq will be the first step. To realize that dream, you're going to create a conflict in Iran, in Syria, in Iraq, and in Turkey, all of which have large, significant Kurdish minorities. So what would we have done? We've left behind preconditions for a terrorist safe haven that would definitely follow us home. Divide, you know, when you can't win, when in doubt, divide, has sort of worked, even though it hasn't been very honorable, in Vietnam and Palestine and India and Cyprus and whatnot. Except in those cases, we were able to say, okay, we couldn't resolve this conflict, let them fight it out, we're tired of it. You know, we're not willing to have more body bags. We're going to quit. And we quit, and that conflict, wherever it was, continued. This conflict, if we abandon it prematurely, is going to follow us home. If anybody still had the misconception that America is an immune, freestanding island, immune from what's happening in the rest of the world, 9/11 should have been a lesson. And those who propose that we should cut and run and leave terrorism and radicalism to continue to foment in Iraq, in the rest of the Middle East, and in the Islamic world in general, have something coming. I hope it doesn't come. But it is proven that terrorism will follow us unless we suppress it. We shouldn't have a timetable. You just don't give the enemy your plan. You don't then tell them when you plan to end the fight. We have to change our tactics. We have to find some sort of a devolution of power. We have to encourage a stable Iraqi government to have a proper power-sharing formula, a proper sharing of the oil wealth, and a proper sharing of the revenues of the state. We have to withdraw the troops to the central and eastern Iraq. Take them away from the vision of Iraqis. Nobody likes an occupier. Everybody was euphoric when Saddam fell. Everybody threw flowers and rice on the invading American army, which were seen as a liberator then. But soon they became the occupier. When you're the occupier, try not to stand in the way. Make sure you stabilize the place, you leave it in a little better than you found it, and get out as soon as you can. You try to rebuild their economy. You rely on special forces to haunt the militants. You cut waste. 55% of the reconstruction cost was spent on overhead. You do better management. Only 12,000 weapons out of 500,000 that were shipped to Iraq have registration numbers. You deal with the Syrian and the Iraqi intervention, and we'll get to that later. And most importantly, while you're doing that, you reduce anti-American sentiments by dealing with the core issues, which are the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Muslim feeling of infinite blind American bias while their dignity is being trampled on, and you tackle the social and economic issues in the Muslim world at large. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farrar. Our next speaker is Ambassador Peter Galbraith. Thank you.
A strategy is a plan that is based on a realistic assessment of the situation that takes into account the resources that you are prepared to commit to the endeavor, considers the prospects for success, and considers the costs, not only in material and troops, but in opportunities foregone elsewhere and in risks that you entail. Now, we have heard the consequences of not staying the course for victory in Iraq. A resurgent and powerful Shiite movement closely aligned with Iran. The rise of Sunni fundamentalism. Civil war and partition. But the interesting thing is that all this has already happened. So the question is, can we devise a strategy toward our goal in Iraq? And what is that goal? Described by my colleague, it is a stable democratic, and united Iraq. That's also the goal as stated by President Bush, and I'm sure there won't be any disagreement on the goal. So now let us consider, what is the current situation in Iraq? What would be required to get to that goal of a stable, united, and democratic Iraq? And then, is it worth it as compared to our other national security priorities? President Bush repeatedly asserts that the Iraqi people have voted for national unity. And his officials insist that there's no civil war in Iraq, only sectarian violence. Neither proposition, however, is true. And the administration's operating assumption that there are a single Iraqi people has led to unachievable goals and to a consistent propensity to underestimate the challenge the United States faces. The Iraqis have, in fact, chosen disunity. This isn't the British, incidentally, British, not the Americans, dividing India. This is their own choice. In the 2005 elections, Shiites voted overwhelmingly for Shiite religious parties. Sunni Arabs boycotted the first set of elections and then voted almost unanimously for Sunni religious or nationalist parties, while the Kurds voted unanimously for Kurdish nationalist parties. No Iraqi party received support from both Kurds and Arabs, and fewer than 1 in 10 Iraqi Arabs voted for parties that crossed the Sunni-Shiite divide. And the Iraqi Kurds voted for full independence in a non-binding referendum conducted simultaneously with the January 2005 elections. 98.7% voted for independence. Iraq's divisions are reflected in Iraq's constitution, a document approved by 80% of the Iraq's people. It recognizes Kurdistan as a region and allows other parts of the country to form their own regions, which the Shiites are now doing. Under the constitution, regions can have their own armies, they have substantial control over their own oil resources, and regional law supersedes federal law unless it relates to a minimal list of exclusive federal powers. The central government is so powerless under the Iraqi constitution that it cannot even impose a tax. General, they'd like that in Fox News. On the ground, the Iraqi state has disintegrated. Kurdistan is in all regards, almost all regards, an independent state. The Iraqi flag is banned in Kurdistan, and by Kurdistan law, the Iraqi army cannot enter Kurdistan. Iraq's Shiite south is governed by religious parties that enforce an Iranian-style Islamic law with militias that number in the tens of thousands. The central government exercises virtually no authority in the southern half of Iraq, and of course, the much-advertised democratic human rights protections of the Iraqi constitution, they don't apply at all. Large parts of the Sunni triangle, that is the Sunni center of the country, are controlled by insurgents and their sympathizers, while the rest is a battleground. Baghdad is the front line of a civil war between Sunnis and Shiites. The Mahdi army, which is the most radical of the Shiite militias, they control the eastern half of the city, while the western half, which is Sunni, is controlled by Al-Qaeda, its offshoots, its imitators, and former Ba'athists. There is, in fact, no place in Iraq where the Iraqi government governs. This analysis, which not even the administration supporters challenge, underscores the folly of a strategy that's based on having the Iraqi government meet certain benchmarks and timelines. Even if all the factions represented in the government could agree on a program of action, as my colleague outlined, the government wouldn't have any power to make it happen. Thus, the militias will not disband in spite of repeated statements, not all of them sincere, from Iraq's leaders that this should happen. The administration's exit strategy, this goal of getting to a unified, democratic, and stable Iraq, relies on having Iraqis take over responsibility for the country's security. Hence the emphasis on building up the Iraqi army and police. This makes sense if the army and police are being asked to battle a foreign enemy, an insurgency, or even to contain sectarian violence. But in circumstances of civil war, the security forces are partisans in the conflict, not neutral guarantors of public safety. This is why the administration goes to such lengths to say, no, no, it's not a civil war. But saying it isn't a civil war doesn't mean it isn't a civil war. And Iraq's security forces, in fact, are active combatants in the civil war. Shiite police units are responsible for the kidnapping, torture, and executions of thousands of Sunnis, while the Sunni police include many insurgent sympathizers, or guess what? They are the insurgents. The Iraqi army, while marginally better, is also divided along sectarian and ethnic lines and largely ineffective. Whole battalions do not show up for combat duties they don't like or believe in. Training Iraq's security forces primarily produces more lethal combatants in the civil war. It is not going to provide for a unified Iraq. It's not going to provide for stability. So what would it take to achieve the president's goal of a unified, stable, and democratic Iraq in circumstances where the country is broken up, where there's civil war, where the army and police are combatants in the civil war? Well, it would take two military steps that we are not prepared to do, and I ask my colleagues if they believe anybody in this country, in this administration, is prepared to do either of these things. First, if you want a unified and democratic Iraq, you're going to have to disband the Shiite militias, and you're going to have to disband the theocracies in the South that violate the human rights. That would involve a whole new military mission. It would involve taking on Shiite forces. The Shiite population is three times the Sunni population. We require at least several hundred thousand more troops. Incidentally, we'd also be the Shiites have a powerful ally, which the Sunnis don't have, next door, Iran. If we wanted to end the civil war, we can't rely on the Iraqi police. They're fighters in the civil war. They're the death squads. So we would have to become the police in Baghdad and other mixed areas. That means many more troops. And, of course, policemen can't sit up in their tanks and armored vehicles. They have to be out among the population. It would mean many more casualties. But the fact is, President Bush is not serious about the unified and democratic Iraq. He has no intention of following a course to victory. So staying the course, at least in the terms of what the United States is likely to do, is not, in fact, a plan for victory. Now, why should we get out of Iraq? Well, obviously the human cost, the financial cost, but there's a national security cost. President Bush has said, United States repeatedly, you've heard this, we will not accept a nuclear-armed Iran or North Korea, the two other members of the Axis of Evil. Yet, while we've been in Iraq, North Korea became the only country to withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, take plutonium that had been under safeguards, reprocess it, detonate a nuclear bomb, and what have we had from this administration? A lot of tough talk, completely unacceptable, and no action. Iran is doing exactly the same thing. It's going full speed ahead with its nuclear program. While we're tied up in Iraq, Iranian politicians openly mock President Bush. They say, you can't do anything. Why? Because if you're in Iraq, our allies, the people you put in power, they can attack your troops in the southern half of Iraq. So by prioritizing Iraq with our other national security objectives, which include stopping these Axis of Evil countries from acquiring nuclear weapons, it's readily apparent that the goal of a unified and democratic Iraq has too remote a chance of success to justify sending in several hundred thousand more troops in terms of time and our inability to deal with other problems. And so if we're not going to spend the resources to promote democracy, end civil war, or counter Iran's influence, and as I said, Bush has no intention of doing this, then we should withdraw from those parts of Iraq, including the Baghdad and the south, where we have no achievable mission. If we're not going to disband those militias, why should we be in the south? It's actually fairly stable. It's theocratic, but it's stable. And if we're not going to end the civil war, if we're not going to be the police in Baghdad, why should we be there? There remains one goal that does justify a major effort, and that is preventing al-Qaeda from having a base in the Sunni Arab areas Al-Qaeda is a Sunni organization. They consider Shiites even bigger enemies than Western infidels. So it's not a problem in the Shiite areas. It's a problem in the Sunni areas. And what we don't want is Al-Qaeda to have a base in those Sunni areas, more or less like what they had in Afghanistan under the Taliban. But our current approach, staying the course, building up that Iraqi army, which of course is a Shiite army, is not working. So as the alternative is to encourage the Sunnis to establish their own region with all the powers that, with their own army as allowed by Iraq's constitution, same thing as the more or less independent Kurdistan, and see if they can be, if they will be prepared to take on Al-Qaeda. Now, we know the current strategy isn't working. We cannot say that a Sunni region with a regional army will, in fact, do what needs to be done. And for that reason, I urge, as a final element of a new strategy, a strategy to protect America's interests rather than to try to pursue a unified and democratic Iraq, as a part of that strategy, that we have keep an over-the-horizon force in Kurdistan. It's stable. It aspires to be democratic. It's pro-Western. And it has it has the best indigenous army in Iraq, and they're on our side. They fought on our side in 2003. That we keep a force there from which we could intervene in the Sunni areas if necessary. And incidentally, the Kurds love President Bush. After all, he's the guy who wrecked Iraq. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Galbraith. Our next speaker on the affirmative side is General Tom McInerney. Your floor.
Should the United States stay the course for victory in Iraq? Yes, strategically we have no choice if we want to defeat Islamic extremism in the global war on terror. Iraq is in fact the central front in the global war on terror. For those that have doubts about that and look at the mainstream media, let me just refer that Osama bin Laden and Zawahiri say it is so. President Bush and the U.S. government says it is so. Supporting documents are the U.S. Congress Public Law 107-243, in which I testified in front of both the Senate Armed Services Committee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. None of those senators, none of them, and it was voted for, ever asked, was going into Iraq central to, was it part of the global war on terror? There was no question in their mind. No one tried to parse it. Now, 3.5, 4 years later, you see different views on it for political reasons. In 1998, the Congress passed another law, PL 105-235, in which the president should take appropriate action to handle Saddam Hussein. Both these Congresses, these Senates, were Democratic Senates at that time with a majority. Now, our threat is Islamic extremism, an ideology that is far worse than Nazism, fascism, and communism. And if you don't understand what the threat is, then you cannot understand why our presence is there to change the region. On September 11, 2001, there were 8 countries that were part of a web of terror, and these 8 countries must be dealt with in different ways. So far, we've dealt with 3 of them. Afghanistan was a regime change. We are still there with elections, a constitution, and NATO is now involved with that insurgency. It is increasing, and it's increasing for a reason, because the Islamic extremists know if you have a moderate government there, then, in fact, their vision of taking the region back to the 7th century, where all women are in burqas, where Sharia law dominates, honor killings dominates, that's the world they want to go to. Iraq. Iraq is crucial. We changed the regime. We had an election, we had a constitution, but we are seeing increasing pressure, particularly this time in the stage of the battle, because they want to influence our election here. Is it a tough fight? You bet it's a tough fight, because they know if they can win there and we withdraw, then the Islamic extremism can dominate the region. That ideology will dominate. Libya. Libya took an off-ramp with the Proliferation Security Initiative. They changed their behavior. They gave us a treasure trove of nuclear technology and where they were in that process, and they have now moved back in to a moderate regime. What are we faced with? Iran. Iran is a major instigator of terrorism in the region. I just got back from a week in Israel. Iraq has 20,000 people in southern Iran that are creating problems with us. They're funded by Iran. They are the major proponent of destabilization in Iraq today. In Lebanon, as you know, they are the supporter of Hezbollah. In Gaza, Hamas is funded by Iran. On the West Bank, Hamas is funded by Iran. They have declared that they will wipe Israel off the face of the earth and eliminate the United States. If they have nuclear weapons, they will put them in our cities. Ahmadinejad has said that. He believes the 12th Imam will come out of a well in Qom when two-thirds of the world's population is killed through pestilence, disease, and warfare. And we want him to have nuclear weapons? Now, we have 1 year left of diplomacy before we have to make a decision with Iran. And I believe we ought to have the Iranian people take their country back and let them create a democratic government. The mullahs are dancing on razor blades, and they need to create problems, and they need those nuclear weapons if they're going to have hegemony in the region. Syria, Bashar Assad must decide if he wants to change politics or there will be a regime change there. Saudi Arabia must stop supporting this drastic form of Islam called Wahhabism. That is driving the ideology in the region, and that is driving the region back towards the 7th century. It is not an ideology of the future. It is an ideology of going back to the 7th century. Pakistan must continue their reforms. Musharraf is dancing on razor blades there. He is leading them in the right direction, but in all honesty, he is a chameleon. North Korea, they have detonated their first weapon. They will move technology into Iran, and that's where our problem will become most severe. Now, that's the web of terror that you've got to understand that overlays this whole problem. Now, Iraq and our forward strategy. Why are we in Iraq? You defeat ideologies by going to their breeding grounds, as we did in Germany and Japan and Italy after World War II. We created moderate governments there. You do not defeat ideologies by defending JFK or Newark. You must be there to change those ideologies, and we are trying to create moderate governments with what I call the five freedoms: education, economics, information, government, and the individual. That's democracy. It'll be their form. Iraq is the center of gravity in this region. If Iraq goes a direction of extremism, and the other side hasn't said the consequences, if Iraq goes in that direction and the United States pulls out, you will find that they'll then take Kuwait, they'll sweep across Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, and those states, and into Jordan and Egypt. You will then have $30 to $50 a gallon of oil, and America will not go back. They will have defeated our will. And Osama bin Laden has said that America does not have the will to persevere. And in 25 years, you will have an Islamic flag over the White House, and every woman here will wear a burqa. If you read their writings, and the problem is the mainstream media does not let you know what they're writing. I have to, because of Fox News, I have to read every day their writings on the web, on Al Jazeera, Al Arabia, and what they are saying. That is their goal. Now, the cut-and-run strategy will not solve this problem. It exacerbates the problem. So a moderate Iraq is critical to a moderate Middle East and the world. We did not ask for this war, but to deny or hope it goes away is not a strategy. We must stand firm. We must create this moderate government that we're trying to. Now, a nuclear Iran is not acceptable, as those nuclear weapons will be put in our cities. And none of us want those consequences. But you must understand that is their stated goal. Iraq is just a way station to where they have a global Islamic extremist caliphate, and that is the challenge that we must understand and must learn about. Thank you very much.
The final speaker addressing the negative point of view and endorsing the negative side of this discussion is Mike O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution.
Thank you, Professor. It's an honor to be here. I agree with 90% of what I just heard from General McInerney, who I greatly admire, as well as the rest of his panel. A year ago, if this debate had occurred on this question in this place, I would have asked to be on this team. I agree fully with the importance of the stakes, with the nobility of the cause. I would have predicted a more successful venture. 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, when you were, Dan, in Syracuse, I was at Brookings doing the same job I have now, so no progress there. And and I thought that while I was advocating much more muscular preparation, and I was on the Shinseki side of the debate, I still nonetheless thought we could pull this off, and I supported the operation. I still want to see us salvage something, but I no longer think that anything close to staying the course is likely to succeed. For me, it's a question of pragmatic judgment about where we are. One of the hardest questions for you this evening at the end is going to be to figure out when you decide how to vote, and as you go ahead in your next few months and years of your lives and think about this question, as we all will, what is the question? Stay the course. What does that mean? Neil did a very nice job of pointing out that, in a sense, we've given the team on my right a Herculean task, because even their own number one proponent of the policy, President Bush himself, no longer nominally is on this side of the question, because he has himself said the rhetoric that he used several months ago, he doesn't consider an accurate characterization of his policy any longer. So what do I mean by change the course? I do not mean withdrawal. I do not mean complete withdrawal of American troops in the coming months. In this sense, you may decide that there are more than two camps represented in this debate tonight, and I apologize for bending or breaking rules. But I think that we have to define the question in a specific way, and for me the question is not stay the course in the exact form that we've been doing it, because this team is far too sophisticated to advocate that, nor is it complete and immediate American disengagement from the problem in all of its entirety. Now, my teammates may be in favor of a more near-term troop withdrawal, but even they are talking about American engagement at some level. I would actually advocate a fairly muscular continued American presence for a substantial period of time, but I'm going to make two central points in my remaining minutes. One, let's begin with a clear diagnosis. It is going badly, and we are starting to lose. That point needs to be clearly in all of our heads. General McInerney would probably agree with me that even if there is a lot of doubt among the military, they still think they can salvage something. Maybe the talk of victory is no longer what it once was. Maybe the best case is no longer what it once was. But I still think we can salvage something. But you've got to begin with a clear diagnosis of the situation. For 2.5 years, I thought we were on an admittedly very difficult but nonetheless promising path towards a reasonable outcome. But in 2006, a couple of things happened. It was already very difficult in 2004 and 2005, as we all know. 2006, the theory that elections would build a new Iraq was largely invalidated, at least in the short term. And Ambassador Galbraith has done a very nice job of explaining why. People were not voting, for the most part, for a new Iraq. They were voting for their sectarian groups. There was still a chance that good political leadership would have found a way to bridge across the different sects and compromise so that a coalition government would be formed in the course of 2006 that would give enough to each group that there could be the basis for a new nation. And I hope they can still pull it off. But 2006 has been a lousy year in that regard. 2006 is the year the Civil War began. I resisted using that term for 3 years. I no longer think there is a serious case against using that term. We can talk about the degree of civil war, and I think it could get a lot worse. And that's one of the reasons I don't favor anything like near-term complete American withdrawal. But it's a civil war by any standards of the term in terms of sheer amount of violence and inter-ethnic killing. So Iraq is fracturing. It is fissioning. I don't think it has yet failed. Ambassador Galbraith does think it has failed. So within our team, there is a complexity of viewpoint. But the key thing for the question before us tonight is that we have to recognize the policy is failing and we are starting to lose. That's my diagnosis. My prescription is to say the following. Let's still hope. Let's be patient. Let's not assume that because we are losing now, we necessarily will always keep losing. So I don't want to get out right away. But you got to give me some reason to believe that it might turn around. What's the reason? What's the logic? What's going to get better? We've got to shock this system. This is a patient that's on the verge of death, and we've got to find some way to shock the patient into a whole different approach. I will put three ideas before you today that I think are the minimum sort of change of course that's going to be needed to give us a decent chance. I would do the first two right away. I would hold the third in reserve for some time next year. Idea number one, and I'll try to be quick, knowing I only have a couple of minutes left. And these may or may not be sufficient. And Ambassador Galbraith has already told me he doesn't think they are. So this is the sort of thing that, at a minimum, I think this is the sort of the minimum as to what a major change of course would be. And the rest of my fellow panelists may be a little more extreme in their thinking. We need a nationwide jobs program in Iraq, something that American military commanders on the scene in those first few months after liberation from Saddam's rule supported and carried out. But then we had, not to be too pejorative, but we had a Halliburton-first strategy. There was a certain logic to that. There was a certain logic that if the violence had subsided, rebuilding the infrastructure in a big way might have given Iraq the kind of quality of life that its citizens expect. But it hasn't worked because the environment is too violent. We need to give people jobs to reduce the number of people who feel totally disenfranchised. Unemployment rate in the Sunni Arab areas is often 50%, 60%. You combine that with the anger of that region, the cynicism, the hatred of the United States and of foreigners, and you've got a witch's brew that produces a huge pool of potential recruits where 90% of all Sunni Arabs support the use of violence against Americans. That's a staggering number. It's even worse than the numbers that Neil quoted in terms of their preference that we not be there. They actually condone, if not support, the use of violence against our troops. So we need to reduce that to the extent possible. I'm not trying to sound like a woolly-headed liberal from Brookings who thinks economics determines everything, but the commanders on the ground that I've talked to, at least several of them, believe a major jobs program that promises a job to every person in Iraq who wants one for a modest wage. And I'm talking about make work. I'm talking about whitewashing the same wall 10 times. I don't care really what it does, as long as it gives people a little bit of a stake in their country's future, the same way that FDR created jobs in the 1930s, as much as anything to give people hope. That's idea number one. Now, you may not consider that to be changing the course in a radical way, but I've approached administration officials about this idea. They don't deny the logic, but they seem to have a more laid-back view. Well, it'd be great if somebody else paid for it, like the Saudis, for example. That's an answer I got from a high-ranking official. Yes, it would be great, but the Saudis aren't doing it, and if we think it's a good idea, we should do it. So I'm on the change the course side, because I don't see enough sense of urgency from the administration on ideas like this. Possibility number two is to try to find a virtue in their disagreement, to create more leverage with the Iraqi government. President Bush can present himself as the good cop and go say to Mr. Prime Minister al-Maliki, you know what, I want to stay the course, but these Democrats won't let me. And the country in the United States is increasingly on their side. And if you don't make the reforms you need to make to share oil equally with the Sunni Arabs, to rehabilitate former Ba'athists who don't have blood on their hands directly, lower-level ones, to rein in those militias, to make other reforms, we're going to have to reduce our commitment because we can't ask Americans to die for a losing cause. That's the bottom line. The cause is noble, but we can't ask Americans to die if there's no chance of victory. And right now, it's increasingly hard to make the case that there's any chance of victory. Well, that is the essence of what I would combine as my two main proposals. It's enough of a change of course that I belong on this side of the auditorium. The third idea I'll very quickly summarize, and it's basically not a complete partitioning of Iraq, but a soft partitioning, where you imagine Sunnis, Shia, and Kurds living essentially in their own autonomous regions. You still insist on equal sharing of oil. But one more additional feature of this, beyond what Senator Biden and Leslie Gelb have advocated, and other people who have talked about this before, you may have to let Iraqis relocate and help them relocate from one part of the country to the other, not because they want to. Iraqis prefer multi-ethnic Iraq as it's been, but because there may not be any other choice much longer. And rather than see this kind of an ethnic separation occur as a result of a Rwanda-scale massacre, I would rather talk about whether the Iraqis would want to facilitate it as part of policy.
Thank you all on both sides. I think it was a very formidable and excellent defense of your positions. Come now, when you, the audience, decide which side you felt was more persuasive this evening. Those of you who felt the affirmative side of the question, should the U.S. stay the course for victory in Iraq, gather on the right. Those who felt the negative side won, gather on my left. Pretty even split, but no, I can't call it even. Yeah, I'll call it even. First even split in the history of the great debates. Thank you.
You've been listening to Boston University's 22nd Great Debate, sponsored by the College of Communications Department of Journalism. Tonight's question was, should the United States stay the course for victory in Iraq? Arguing in the affirmative was Adib Farah, a senior policy advisor to the American-Lebanese Coalition and vice president of Cardiovascular Hospitals of America, and retired Air Force Lieutenant General Thomas McInerney, founder of the consulting firm Government Reform Through Technology and currently the military affairs analyst for Fox News. Arguing in the negative was Peter W. Galbraith, political consultant and former ambassador to Croatia, and Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Journalism Department Chairman Robert Zelnick. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skog. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.